You ever had the experience of being out of sync with your home? You open your front door and trip over a jumble of boots and hockey sticks. You look at your living room and realize your grandmother would be very comfortable in it, but you aren't. Or your friends suggest there might be a more original color choice for your walls, something other than white. And the problem, of course, is that it's one thing to buy a house, it's quite another to make it a home. Well, science writer Winifred Gallagher has come to the rescue of those of us who are decor-challenged. In her new book, House Thinking, she writes that behavioral and environmental science can teach us quite a lot about how to make a house a home. Gallagher collected the best of this advice and, along the way, rethought her own home, room by room.
The first thing that really struck me was the entry, and I think this is a problem for a lot of us. The entry to your home should be a very, very special place. So what a good entry to a home should say is you have now left the mad, wild, crazy world behind you, and you are entering this wonderful private refuge. And what a lot of our entries say, I'll talk about two different types. In the city, people who live in apartments or smaller houses don't have a lot of space. And the entry to their homes tends to be a dumping ground. It's where the recycling goes and the rubber boots and the kids' backpacks. And it's the exact opposite of the message that you want to send to yourself and to your friends when they enter your home. Now, in the suburbs, and most Americans do live in the suburbs, it's a car culture. And suburban houses, all of them, have nice front doors with often a nice entry hall and maybe some pretty appointments in the hall. But the only person who ever sees it is maybe the UPS man, because everybody else drives up the driveway, often right smack into the garage. So here's your entry experience to your home. You drive into the garage, you get out of your car, you open a metal utility door that goes into the laundry room that leads you to the kitchen. This is hardly saying I've left the mad, stressful world behind and I'm now in my wonderful sheltering private refuge.
Well, let's move on. I don't want to spend the entire time in the entryway to your house. Where do you go next? Most of us, I suppose, would go straight into the living room. Is that true for
you,
too?
That's right. Yep, that sure is. And the living room is the most expressive, the most personal room in the house. Even in very simple houses in early colonial America or in parts of the third world still, where people, if they have two rooms, one of them is the room for good. So it's an important place for you to express to yourself and to your friends and family who you are, where you came from, and what you value. That's all kind of on display in the living room, in the kinds of things that we put there, whether it's bronze baby shoes or, you know, a nice painting or a collection of pottery that you pick up over your vacation. Second, it's a social room. It's a room that should say, in our home, we welcome friends and family. We value people more than televisions. If I could wave my magic wand doing psychological renovations of American homes, really the main thing I would do, if not banish the television set from the living room, at least put it off to one side and down low so that the living room doesn't look like a church where the television is the altar and you're all lined up in front of it worshiping the great god of TV.
Right, where it's not the main thing
that's
there.
Sitting there staring at a flickering screen. It's the place where you should be talking to people and curled up with a book maybe, or watch television, sure, but don't make it the focus of your room.
The same sort of thing happens when I look through magazines, and we do, you know, we look at our house and we look then in magazines and see pictures of kitchens, for instance, that look so appealing until you begin to think about what they would actually be like if you were to use them. They're huge, and places that look like you could put a whole restaurant staff in them are...
Well, yeah, a restaurant-caliber kitchen is now a big, big status symbol in America. It's sort of like back in my youth in the 60s, maybe it was having like a big Cadillac or something like that. Now it's having a restaurant-style kitchen. And the funny thing about those kitchens is that we are now actually cooking radically fewer meals than we used to, and eating at home much less than we used to. Even when we do eat at home, a lot of the things are like it's a chicken that you pick up that's already been roasted or takeout. So our kitchens, again, are becoming more and more elaborate, more and more expensive, the less and less we're actually cooking. Frankly, for an awful lot of people, they don't even really need a kitchen anymore. They can get by here in New York City. There are lots of people who don't really have kitchens. They have a little mini fridge. They have a microwave for heating up their takeout. They don't entertain at home. They go to restaurants. For lots of people, that big room that you're talking about could actually kind of send them on a guilt trip. You know, like I have this big I have friends who have like gorgeous kitchens that are ready for the photo shoot, and they feel they never cook, and it makes them feel kind of guilty.
Well, having talked about living rooms and kitchens, I was surprised to discover that you're such an enthusiast about dining rooms. In fact, you even have a chapter heading that says, "How can your dining room help you live longer?"
The dining room was actually invented. It's kind of a Victorian invention that people dreamed up as a way of displaying status. People were spending more time socializing. This was in England. Social life gravitated around the country house. So people came and they had much more leisure time, and they were sitting around having these long meals. So they said, well, we better have like a really nice room to do that in, and let's get some nice silver and dishes and glassware and things to sort of show off to our friends and make the room beautiful. And what research shows now, actually, we don't like to think of ourselves as being attracted to status symbols, but status is a good predictor of your longevity. So that people who, for example, a very, very serious British epidemiologist did some research that showed that people who live in zip codes that are in quote-unquote better neighborhoods actually live a couple of years longer than people with the same socioeconomic profile otherwise who live in a different zip code. So if you can use your dining room in your home, I'm not talking about being snobby or, you know, keeping up with the Joneses or just
but
use
to show
your
off
nice
things that you take satisfaction in.
Yeah, and use nice things that remind you that these rituals are important and that you deserve the best. And, you know, why not? I live in New York, so I can pick up fabulous flowers now on any street corner for $5 or $6. This isn't a big deal. We don't have to, like, wait for Valentine's Day to have flowers on the table.
You know, you're absolutely right. And I think stopping for flowers is one of the nicest things one can do. But I also have to tell you that I never buy fresh flowers to go into the basement. And I'm perfectly happy in the basement.
Yeah, I'm not too keen on the basement myself, but it's my husband's favorite space in the house. He's crazy about it.
A
psychologist, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, the researcher who coined the term flow for optimum human experience, gave a lot of his research subjects beepers, and he would beep them randomly throughout the day, and they would have to record what they were doing, where they were, and how they felt. And he found that men were happiest in the basement. Because for a lot of men, it's kind of their place. They don't have to take any instructions from their companions. And it's a place where that he might have a workbench or keep his tools or, you know, do other things that guys like to do. Women, it was their least favorite part of the house. Women, in Csikszentmihalyi's study, were happiest in the bathroom.
In the bathroom?
And as the mother of five kids, I can really understand that one. It is often the only room in a home that has a locking door. So when the world is too much with you, you can go into the bathroom, lock the door, run a tub, and no one can can bother you for that magic 10 minutes.
And you have to be careful with them, too. I don't know whether you have run across anything like this. I just decided recently when I was in a store buying, I've forgotten what we were there for, a laundry basket or something. But I saw one of those fog-free mirrors and decided I would put it up in the shower so that I could shave while standing there with the hot water pouring over me, which sounded like a really nice idea. I discovered it's not all that nice, actually, to see yourself when you're in the shower, however.
Bingo. Exactly. I think there's a strong correlation between the rise of our self-monitoring technology and the rise in things like anorexia, bulimia, body dysmorphic disorder. We have to remember that for most of history, until really relatively recently, people didn't have things like bathroom scales. Until the late 19th century, mirrors were very unusual. People didn't have them. So people just simply couldn't obsess about the way they looked. I'm in my 50s. Do I want to, it's the first thing in the morning, walk into the bathroom and look at a magnifying mirror? I really don't. Not before I have some coffee.
No,
So there's no reason why we have to turn our bathrooms into these laboratories filled with equipment. They really should be, you know, private sanctuaries where we can kind of relax and take care of ourselves.
Makes sense to me. Winifred Gallagher is a science writer and journalist. You'll find more of her thoughts about how to make a house feel right in her book, House Thinking, a room-by-room look at how we live.